This is the Chariot Solutions TechCast number 106 with our new sub-series, Meet a Charioteer. In this series, we round up some of our consultants to talk passion projects, opinions, interesting challenges, and anything and everything in between, whether tech-related or not. Today, our host Ken Rimple talks to Anatoly Polinsky. Anatoly has been consulting for Chariot for over 7 years now, most recently working with functional programming languages like Clojure. Anatoly and Ken chat about problem solving, the unique role of a developer, Clojure, REPLs, having kids, and why so many software folks seem to also be talented musicians. Now, onto the interview with Anatoly Polinsky.
Welcome to our unnamed podcast slash video. We have no idea what we're going to call this yet. I've been banding about things like get to know a developer or life in development trenches, but that can have a negative connotation too. So we'll figure up a name for this. But my first guest for this particular stream of podcast is Chariot's Anatoly Polinsky. And that's our artificial hello since we just talked to each other 2 minutes ago. Anatoly is one of our architects developers on projects at Chariot. How long have you been here?
For seven and a half years.
One of the areas you focus a lot on is functional programming and Clojure, and we'll talk a lot about that. But I guess what we'll start out with is, what was your first way that you got into computers?
So I was probably 9 or 10, and I'm from Ukraine, so in Ukraine, to own something like IBM-compatible computer in 89 or 90 was not something that you can afford.
Right.
So there was this clones of the computer that used to be called ZX Spectrum.
Oh yeah.
So ZX Sinclair it was done by Sinclair Research Ltd. from London, and Soviets. Mm-hmm. We copied all the schematics and we kind of distributed them to low markets, and people just bought it and made the clones themselves. And so, but you had to be like an artist to make that clone because nothing worked. You had to like calibrate it and what I was. Fortunately, my father is such an artist, so he put it together for me. I helped him as much as I could.
At 9,
we were always in radio electronics, so I knew some things, but mm-hmm. not others. And unfortunately, that computer should have had 64 kilobyte of operating system, but only had 16, so I couldn't play any games. But the BASIC was built in. So when I turned it on and did print hello, and I see hello on the TV, That was the moment.
So BASIC was your first love because that was your first language.
Yeah,
I'm not sure if it was really a love affair for me either,
I can't say BASIC is my first love. BASIC is my first
language,
first gateway into this interaction. Mm-hmm. So that was magic for me. It was, I just printed here on a physical thing.
Look, it came out,
and I hear it on the screen. It was fantastic.
And then comes the shores of disappointment when you finally get to an IBM PC.
it happened much into the future. In the future, but mm-hmm. I probably got the first Pentium 1 was my first IBM compatible PC, mm-hmm. and it was 7 years since. So by then, I already knew what to expect.
So as you're learning this stuff and you're learning how programming works a little bit by experimentation, scientific method, so to speak, mm-hmm. hook with a sharp stick, you know. What language do you really, like, completely click with early on that, like, made you think more like a developer, like a programmer?
Well, when I was a kid, I thought that that assembly is the real true language. The reason for that is because it was closer to metal, and since I'm talking to the metal, I should be speaking that this metallic language that metal understands. Everything else is kind of, you know, human fluff on top of it. And this was an 8-bit assembly language, so it's not like Microsoft Assembler or Turbo Assembler. That was just a little more primitive. But when you can get, the line to fly around the screen, you know, using all the right interrupts and all the cool stuff, that I thought that what makes me, you know, closer to the machine, and that what makes me, I didn't think of that as a programmer or a developer back then. It just makes me a better, you know, friend to the machine. As time progresses, of course, there were a lot of languages. Pascal was my, I think, first higher level language after BASIC, of course. Mm-hmm. Then C++, then C, and all the usual Java. And I think, in order to answer the question, what language kind of made me think that this is the great language for development, and I'm a good developer because of this language, I need to understand first what the good developer is, right?
Yeah.
Because I mean, I think language really matters secondary to be a good developer.
It's a technique and understanding.
Language is more like a tool, but it's extremely important. It's extremely important. It's it makes you think a certain way. It allows you to be faster or slower or better thinker, or you know, focus on business problem sooner rather than later, mm-hmm. because of all the ceremony that different languages have. But I think it's secondary. I think experience and being around people, connecting reality to problems, to machines, that's probably the first. Language would be the secondary. Yeah,
it always seems like we're kind of dancing around the subject of problem solving and breaking problems into smaller parts. And
divide and conquer.
And like, even no matter what language you use, you have to think that way as an engineer. If you don't think that way, you're going to make a heap of code that may not be all that useful or reusable.
Yeah, I think as consultants, though, we have this unique position. And if you want to be any good, of course, we're in this unique position where we connect, we kind of make the triangle hold. So, and by triangle, I mean there's a three pieces to the puzzle, the way I think. Mm-hmm. So there are scientists, right? So there's science. There's science behind the problem. So if problems didn't have science behind them, it wouldn't be that easy to solve. It wouldn't be that interesting to solve, and that there would be, you know, just a mechanical process of putting things together. So that's not what we do, right? So we have the science behind the problem. So that's one thing. But scientists usually, if you're talking about, if you think about field of science, they don't see reality that well, right? So they're in their scientific, they're very good, they're very deep, but they don't deal with reality that much. Right? Somebody takes that science and uses it for reality.
Right.
Then the second part of this triangle is making things, right? Executing that problem, executing that solution for that problem.
Mm-hmm.
So people who just, like mechanical Turks kind of people who just do things, they don't see the science of it, right? So they're completely separated. Sometimes they see reality, sometimes they don't. And the third, of course, is reality. And usually people are behind that reality. So we're in this unique position of kind of building those bridges between the three and walking people over from one bridge to another.
It's funny because I think they had, was it Silicon Valley, had the conjoined triangles of success joke, because everything is usually broken out into like these ratios between things or arrangements between two or three or four different things. And but I like the way that you kind of broke that apart.
I didn't mean to be cliche.
No, I know you weren't.
It's just something that I feel like.
Sure.
That this is what we do. I mean, and in order to be good at it,
right?
It's not enough to, you know, to know some of science. It's not enough to, and we're never going to be exceptionally great at science because we're not scientists.
Right.
But it's not enough to know your programming language, for example,
right.
or your tools, and it's not enough to just know, you know, how to speak to two people or three people. It's that combination of everything, constant learning of all three.
It's a really good way of putting it. So what do you think some of the problems today in software development you see over and over again that people keep, like, maybe not necessarily repeating mistakes, but resolving the same things that you could look at it in maybe a different way? I'm not sure that's a good question.
Well, that's fine. I mean, I think it's not just problem. People are different in nature, right? So some people are short-tempered, some people are like to think for too long.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some people approach problems jumping from place to place.
Mm-hmm.
Some people just sit and, you know, and become one with the problem. There are different approaches to do that, and I think if you're talking about mistakes...
And maybe mistake isn't the right term, but maybe more some challenges you just keep dealing with over and over again in your role as a consultant that you think that... maybe there's some sort of thing that we could bring to a higher level.
So I just thought of one. So and maybe it'll grow to the second one. So it's usually most of people that I work with, a lot of people that I work with, they programmers, the developers, they would trust a tool or a company or a framework or you know, something that's already done and that should solve, you know, the problem at hand. And usually that kind of results in problems of people solving the problem, but also people fighting that tool or framework or company approach, and they try to fit their solution in that framework or fit their solution in the problem. And a lot of time, like, you know, 20%, 30%, 40% is wasted on not just solving the problem or not just using this tool efficiently, but to marry the two, right? Whereas maybe there is a way to, as you mentioned before, to split it on smaller pieces or divide and conquer on the problem, and maybe certain pieces would fit the tool great, but it doesn't mean that if you're using this tool that you have to use it for all the pieces of the project.
It's not your hammer for everything you should be doing.
Right, yeah. And it's not your umbrella as well. It's not you
can't. Oh, that's a good way of putting it, yeah.
You can't just cover all these pieces with this one tool, or framework, or solution, or whatever. Of course, there is also the pain of internal frameworks and internal tools that you have to use if you work for certain companies, especially if companies are any large. Yeah. They will require you to use their blah blah framework, right? So that's the plan. It's like a plague, right? But there's always a people element, right? If you establish your credibility, you know, early on, you can kind of break out of that loop and focus on break out those problems, and maybe prototype something quick, show that this is possible. Because it all ends up being to. Do people are people ready to pay for something that for a change? Right? Change is always hurt businesses. At least that's how people who pay money look at things.
Right.
It works right now. I don't want to break it. You know, it gets to my revenue. I'm a middle manager, or whatever. And it pays my bills. I don't want to do anything about it. And there of course people like that, or there are better managers, or great managers, mm-hmm. that would say that okay, let me try to see what can I do better, and. We are the people who are there to show that this is how you can do better, you know, and this is why your solution will become a lot more flexible to change. This is why you can take on more work later, you know, become an even better manager or move up higher, not just because of the position, but because you actually have more work, because you can now afford to change it. Your system is so elastic that you can afford to change it frequently, you know. And I don't mean the agile process, I just mean the flexible system that loves changing, right?
Right.
That's built, that's composable.
Well, and let's talk about that a little bit. So one of the areas that you're really passionate about, I know you from at Chariot, that you're so strong with, is functional programming.
Right.
And so tell me how, and whether it's Clojure or Lisp or whatever, I mean, you can do it in Scala, you can kind of barely do it in JavaScript.
Right.
But tell me a little bit about why functional matters and like what the change in thinking does for you when you're writing software.
Right, so it didn't happen overnight, of course,
mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying that this programming aid or the approach of programming aid is better than the approach.
Oh, sure.
They're just different, and there's different way to think about things,
mm-hmm.
but I was a big, and I still is, a big Spring proponent,
mm-hmm.
like in Java Spring. I know that it's not as popular as it used to be in Java, and you know, but it's still, you know, pumping. There's still a lot of people use it, and still there's some innovative things there. And you know, they just kind of understood that the world is moving. They kind of try to catch on to where the world is moving with the, you know, with the React and with Kotlin and all that.
Mm-hmm.
But and of course, I'm not using Spring actively anymore,
mm-hmm.
because I'm doing more of doing Clojure for most of my work. But when I did that, and I thought that I was pretty good at it. Doing Java and Spring, and I thought about the problems differently, right? When I designed the problems, I would think of the problems in terms of nouns, right? So I would say, what is this piece called? What does this piece do? Does it talk to this piece? What is this
mm-hmm.
piece called? What does this piece do? You know, okay, let's break it out into smaller pieces, and then
nouns, verbing nouns, yeah.
Yeah, so
objects, methods to objects.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly. So they call for message passing, which is the method called invocations, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this is how you design a system. It's not wrong, it's just a way, right? So
yep.
it worked perfectly. Later, as I started learning more programming languages or more different tools, or figured that most of the work that we do is we take data from one place, we transform it, and we put it in another place. Whether that another place is a screen or a database or some different system, it doesn't matter. But that's the most of the bulk of the work. I mean, there are some more interesting problems than that, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But there's
absolutely right.
There's machine learning, artificial intelligence, the different models you can build, whatever. But those models will still be doing what? They would be taking data from one place, transforming it, so the model is just interesting on the transformation part.
That's
right?
What they want, yeah, right.
Right,
mm-hmm.
But then they're going to put it somewhere mm-hmm. else, right? And then they're going to take the data, or neural nets, they do the same thing, they put the data from one, neural nets is an interesting thing, right?
So there's a lot of different steps in the same process,
yeah,
right?
But it's the same, it's you divide and conquer, right? So,
yep.
But it's the same thing, you're taking data from one place and you put it in another place.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that by learning more about functional programming in the beginning of 2000s, I think, or 2004, 5, 6,
mm-hmm.
I figured that there are actually languages or the way to program in a way that you can focus on data first. Not what components work
right.
in each system,
data.
But what data and what's the shape of the data and how it flows. How do you build that pipeline to assist, to solve a particular problem? And that, I think, what functional programming kind of brings into the mix, and that's why it's a little different from the object-oriented programming. So you don't orient across around the object; you orient around data. And Clojure is one. Lisp, in particular, is extremely well suited, in my understanding, in my opinion, extremely well suited for working with data. So you take in data in whatever in various shape or form, and you transform it in certain, you know, in certain in, into the other data and pass it to another form, right? And if you think about this pipeline that you do, those pipelines are just composable functions, right? So you take the data in one place, pass it to the first function, it does something with the data, that passes it to another function, and so forth. So that's basically kind of the meat of what we do. It kind of matched in my brain, it kind of, at least today. It kind of matched in my brain, and I thought that, let me try that, like, do professionally. And that, I think using Clojure for that was a great choice. And I'm glad that I found it as early as I found it.
And you're not just doing Clojure to use it. You also have some open source projects that you kind of scratched itches that you need solved, then ended up becoming libraries, some of which are used by other projects. So what are some of your more popular GitHub repos that have been used by other, I mean, maybe not popular, but used, more used, and things where you have to now kind of almost support a library?
Right. So I do have several. I don't think, I mean, sometimes GitHub stars kind of show you what are more used, but in some cases, for some libraries, it's actually different. So I have, for example, I have this completely non-Clojure library, which is called Colt, C-O-U-L-T, and that's basically just a Docker compose image of Vault and console, of their latest images. So you can just start up and connect Vault to console and keep your stuff in Vault, keep your encrypted stuff in Vault and your configuration in console. It's just something I was using myself, so I decided to kind of lay it out there, and I wrote how to use it and what to do. Mm-hmm. And I know that it's used because I get pinged a lot about it, and sometimes more than my other libraries that Clojure libraries or have more stars, if you will. Mm-hmm. So that would be one. Another one would be with one that seems to be most popular and most controversial in Clojure circles is called Mount, and that has to do with managing state. Because whether you do functional programming or object-oriented programming or XYZ programming or astrophysics programming, I don't care what kind of programming
it is. State somewhere.
You have state somewhere. You have to manage it. And in Clojure, on the primitive level, it's solved with things like Atom, which is like something like atomic reference.
Yep.
Right. But as the application grows, you need to be able to introduce some life cycle to the states. You need to be able to maybe have some interdependencies and all that. So Mount kind of solves that. There are others, state management Clojure libraries, and there's this little in-cultural fight that we have, because in any community, I noticed it with Scala when I did Scala for 2 or 3 years, and I noticed the shift from the Java community, for example. It's Scala back then Scala was really up and coming. And a lot of people were trying to be smart and do all the free monads and don't pay for those monads. And it was okay because I was learning getting my experience, getting up to speed with the category theory and all that. Switching to Clojure community is very different, but you still have people to, there are people who are absoluters the way that I think about them. There's things should be done this way and no other way.
Right.
So I don't think that applies anywhere in life.
So it's hard to be that and be consistent, because something will break your world model.
Well,
and you need to be flexible to things you need to solve, right?
Right. I mean, you preach into the choir. I mean, I can't.
Yeah, yeah.
I can't.
I figure I wouldn't say no to that one.
Yeah, I think pragmatic aspect of Clojure is actually what's cool about it, and at the same time, certain people in the community don't see it that way. That's fine. I mean, I think that's great to have debates about it, because as we talk more about it, as even when I had arguments with people within the community, I learned new things.
There's reasons that they're going that way.
We all have something to that we don't know. I mean, you know a lot of something that I don't know, and vice versa.
Yeah.
Right. So it's good to talk about people, especially when it's not fighting in the street, but we're talking about how to manage state. And,
and arguing passionately for a point of view is a good thing, because it means you, hopefully, you come from a perspective of really understanding your point of view. I think it's always tough when you run into somebody who's absolutely, like, I wouldn't call it absolutist, I would call it an evangelist. That's kind of a dangerous world, because the minute you switch from firmly believing something that you feel very strongly about and you feel there's a way to do it, to saying everyone's got to do it, that's a whole different world. And we've seen that in a lot of frameworks
any community,
and languages.
Any community will have that.
Anything, politics, anything.
And I'm not talking about, you know, some people. There's could be like a group of people that's like that. And it's fine.
Sure.
There's no problem. But I have some other libraries. But the reason I have those libraries and the reason the libraries are there is because when I'm programming in Clojure, when I'm doing Clojure, I spend a lot of time in the REPL. Mm-hmm. And REPL is this read, evaluate, print, loop kind of thing where mm-hmm. Where it's very interactive. So I can break, you know, I can take a small piece of my application or a small piece of my idea, and I can put it in REPL, mm-hmm. and I can see the immediate feedback or immediate error, you know, or immediate failure or immediate success. And I can nurture it and make it better. Mm-hmm. And so because it's so interactive, it makes me, you know, create things faster. Well, at least I think it's faster, because maybe if I was doing, you know, other language today, maybe I would also be faster. But this interactive approach is something that I didn't find anywhere else. Mm-hmm. For example, I have some Go projects. You know that I think Go is a great language. Go is simple. If you don't, you know, pick on the semantics of the word simple, it's very pragmatic and it's a great language. But it's not REPL driven. There are a couple of REPLs for Go as well, but it's just because the language is the way it is.
It's not quite baked in. Yeah,
it's not Go. You can't live in REPL. Right. You can maybe try something, and even trying something is not as easy. Because Lisp is meant to be kind of fragmented and sent over to other systems. Like you take this little piece of that system and a function, right? Not just data, but functions are data. But something that can do something, not just show you that this is what it is, and send it to us at the other system. And REPL kind of shows you that, because you can quickly send and receive the small pieces of code.
So, I had a question about what your favorite developer tools is. I bet number one is the REPL, or at least way up there.
Yeah, I think VI and REPL.
Yeah, VI. It's on every single Linux machine or Mac you'll ever run into, and easy to install. Yeah,
I'm not participating in those VI versus wars.
Well, any good basic editor, right? Yeah.
I mean, VI, just once you configure it, modern, like Atom is a good editor. Visual Studio editor is great, right? Visual Studio Code is great, but I try them all, and sometimes I use some of that. Sometimes I do use IntelliJ for Java and Scala stuff, because mm-hmm. I think it's the best for Java and Scala. Maybe it's also great for Kotlin. I haven't looked at Kotlin very well. I tried a little bit, but I haven't also IntelliJ. But I don't know much about it at the top. But I currently I'm learning Rust. Trying to make sense of lifetimes, mm-hmm. my lifetimes and Rust lifetimes, trying to merge them together.
If you merge them together, you're going to be a cyberpunk in language. It's a little scary.
I also came around a year ago. I came around this language called Zig, Z-I-G.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, I think it has a great potential. I think this is really simple and very pragmatic. Intuitively, you can do a lot already.
Zig, huh? I'll check that one out.
It's great. Language is extremely great, but it's still secondary to working with people, to connect the problems together, to connect reality, to put science in this and in all this. Languages is easier to get satisfactions from. Like if then for example, you go to read about some mathematical theorems or even category theory or whatever. It's not that easy to get pleasure from.
Right.
It will get you. You'll get it later once you learn it. But from language, it's so interactive and it's so good and so easy to compare to other languages that it's easy to get satisfaction from. It's easy to pick up.
So in terms of things that you're paying attention to that aren't tech, I know that you play a little music, you play some guitar and things like that. What are the things outside of tech that you really enjoy doing?
Well, my answer is going to be probably a little boring, but today at this particular stage is my kids.
Nothing boring about that. They're never boring, are they?
No, but it's just that stage. They're little.
Watch them grow. Watch them learn things.
They're 6 and 9, so I can already discuss different theories with them.
Oh, that's great.
Discuss their theories. Their theories are a lot more fun than the ones you find on Wikipedia. And I'm trying to understand how to be a good parent. And I know we all do that. Most of the people do that. But I'm sure that nobody knows how to do that. And we all always wing it.
Yeah.
But this is such a huge responsibility. Like if you screw up a software project, right, or you screw up, some problem at hand and at work, it's one thing. But this is this life that depends on you, that looks at you with huge eyes, and it knows that you're gonna do everything for them, and they don't want to fail them on that. As you mentioned, music. Yes, I do play guitar, and I started playing guitar when I was 14. And I played violin when I was little, but I never, I mean, at 5 or 6, I could read music. Now I can't, right? So I just play guitar without notes. But recently we started, like a year ago, me and my son, we started taking piano lessons. Well, my son is taking piano lessons, and I'm learning with him how to, we have flashcards and everything, and we play piano together. So we, as a very beginner, kind of, but I think music is so common to software
developers, it seems. So many of us play.
I think if you take like science, software development, other fields of people interest, I think music is just way above all them. I just feel it genuinely because.
Yeah.
And I had the recent debate with one of my friends. He's a math professor. Like we were discussing, I mentioned that language of mathematics, to my liking, and I'm not a mathematician, so I can be completely wrong on that. But since I know different programming languages and I understand somewhat how somebody can pick up a language or why language is useful, I feel that language is mathematics because it's forward compatible. It has to always to be forward compatible. Like if a great mathematician did something in the 16th century, mathematician today should be able to look at it and understand what it did.
Yeah.
It's the same language, right?
Absolutely.
But also there's a lot more people that introduce novelty in this language with their own semantics and their own quirks. And you can't really change that. Yes, you can create new things in math. Mm-hmm. So to my understanding, language of mathematics, and mathematicians would hate me for saying that, and that's fine. But it's my opinion that language of mathematics suffers from its complexity and from an inability to be rewritten, right? Because it always needs to be forward compatible. And that's why I think it's harder to pick up math than to pick up something like music, which is a completely different beast, right? Yes, there are, there are maybe, 100 primitives that you need to learn, not just 100. But it's also so simple after that, and then just that it's very composable, right? And the reason it's composable, and we have a composer, right? But the reason he's a composer, and the reason we even have that word, is because music is so composable. Because a little child can know some basic rules, or even breaking the rules, can get something and compose it, whether it's their voice or on the instrument. It just, mathematicians and scientists always try to be closer to understanding the world, right? So I'm working on this to understand the world, but I think musicians have a better chance to have that intimate understanding of the world, because, and I'm not saying that the world is music and nothing else. I'm just saying that
it's a different way to look at
it. The world
is
multidimensional, right?
Absolutely.
So the music is not just to understand one or many or several of those dimensions. I think music is just great. It's just beyond. And unfortunately, I didn't learn, I didn't keep up my violin, and I didn't learn notes.
It's funny. I'm now playing, and this is just like lo-fi, but I was a drummer for years and years and years, and still play now and then. But started playing guitar, and I always played around with it, and I just knew basic, the basic first position chords and things like that. And now that I'm actually playing with this group of musicians setting up a pop band, I'm learning all these different things I never knew, and it's just so great to actually now get the concept of keys and notes and chords and
progressions
and hear things and say, I know that's wrong, and I know I'm playing it wrong, I'm going to work on it and figure it out, and working through it. It's such a nice, different way of looking at life than the day-to-day problem solving of tech. They're both equally valid and useful in the world, but I think one kind of helps make you more rounded for the other in a way.
Yeah, and music is actually, there's a direct relationship between the REPL that I talked about.
Yeah, right, like right, and jamming.
In music you can have an idea and work with your idea at hand.
Right.
Right, that's what Lisps or maybe, you know, REPL
sure.
Driven languages. That's what they give you, right?
Yeah, I totally see the connection.
So it's almost like you're composing music on a sheet, right? Mm-hmm. On a music sheet, versus you know, composing music as you play the instrument.
Right.
So I think composing music on the music sheet is something like Haskell. Right.
It's a good way of looking at it.
I'm not saying it's wrong.
No.
And some people like to do that. Some people like to keep all this in the head and do that, and then mm-hmm. realize it at the end.
Right.
Versus you know something like a Lisp, where you or Clojure, where you work there upon your jam constantly. Mm-hmm. You can also go to the music sheet a little bit, but it's mostly jamming, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then other languages are in the middle.
Yeah.
Somewhere in the middle. Somewhere you can run tests. You can do whatever you know to figure out.
It's a big continuum. Yeah. All right, Anatoly, so much thank you for this interview. It was a lot of fun.
Sure, but that's fun.
Awesome. All right.
Cool. Thanks, Ken.
Thanks again to Anatoly for being on the Chariot Solutions TechCast. For more interviews, check out our podcasts at chariotsolutions.com/podcasts. You can also tweet the show at TechCast or to Chariot Solutions directly at Chariot Solution. Chariot Solutions offers consulting, mentoring, and training in open source languages, platforms, and frameworks. We work with teams of developers to give them an edge in JavaScript language fundamentals, testing and build tools, Angular, React, Scala, and Akka. To learn more about the courses that we offer, visit our training page at chariotsolutions.com/training. That's all for now. Thanks again for listening to the Chariot Solutions TechCast, hosted by Ken Rimple and produced by myself, Becca Efford. Until next time.